Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to Your Booked. I'm Daisy Buchanan. This week we're on the Kent coast, the occasional ends of Somerset Maugham, Chaucer, Dickens and our lit-loving, wit-sharpening guest Andy Miller. Andy is a professional Anita Bruckner fanboy, the author of Tilting at Windmills, The Kinks Are the Village Green Preservation Society, and he's probably best known for his memoir The Year of Reading Dangerously, How 50 Great Books Saved My Life, published by Fourth Estate. In this book, Andy asks why, as a bookseller and publisher, he fell out of love with reading and falls back in by working his way through the literary canon, including Middlemarch, Master and Margarita, and The Da Vinci Code. Lots of listeners will recognise his voice from Backlisted, the Beyoncé of book podcasts from the publisher Unbound, which he co-presents with John Mitchinson. Andy is to publishing what Sir David Attenborough is to conservation. If we still have books as we know them in 100 years' time, we will have his energy, intelligence and enthusiasm to thank. As a point of trivia, I first met Andy at a book festival a couple of years ago. I was hungover in a gold jumpsuit eating a bacon sandwich. He warned me that Martin Parr was roaming around with a camera and about to capture me with HP sauce on my chin. He's an all-round wonderful writer, reader and human being. So I am in the beautifully appointed sitting room of the author, Andy Miller, the author of The Year of Reading Dangerously and podcaster, and many of you must listen to Backlisted. That's a good question. Andy, what do you call this room? Is it a sitting room, a drawing room, what's the other one, lounge?
It's a sitting room, isn't it? I haven't got my Mitfords to hand, so I can't instantly call up the you and non-you terms.
Pretty sure lounge is non-you.
Is it?
Because my nan and grandpa called it a lounge, and if we use that word at home, my mum would tell us off.
It's the sitting room. Yes, it's the sitting room. It's the room we do the sitting in, so that's fine.
This is a lot of books, but it is here. I was kind of envisaging, knowing you to be a big reader, I thought we'd be sort of swimming through them, and this looks quite neat and tidy.
There are books all over the house.
This is
the first room you've made it into, right? So that's the first thing. And the second thing is the other rooms, which you are not allowed in, according to someone close to me who should remain anonymous, who lives here with me. There are books all over the floor in other rooms in the house. This is the most under control.
So what you're really saying is that you have played the property market to your advantage. And you have many rooms.
We have more rooms
and
more
books. Many houses. So tell me about these books that I'm looking at now. I see many books. I can see Beyond Black by Hilary Mantel. I see Everyman by Philip Roth. I see The Dice Man by Luke Reinhardt.
Yeah,
now, I have a feeling, I remember you not enjoying The Dice Man.
Oh, it's terrible. It's an awful book. So from the far left there, you can see there that orange spine is The Master and Margarita by Mikhail Bulgakov. And then if you go across in a straight line, two drops, until you get to here, Howard's End by E.M. Forster. Those are, in the order that I read them, the 50 books that I read for my book, The Year of Reading Dangerously, which I actually read these about in fact, about 10 years ago now. And these are the actual copies that I read. I don't keep them here. It's like in a kind of as a museum to myself, because I don't normally have cause to present them as though they were artifacts or recreations of me 10 years ago when I was reading them. But I keep them in the order that I read them for two reasons. Or keep them on display for two reasons. The first reason is that I'm actually really proud of having read some of these books. And furthermore, they offer quite a broad sweep of types of book. So they do furnish a room, to quote Anthony Pohl, books do furnish a room. They do furnish a room. It's quite nice to have them present in the house and have them there. But also, and this is a thing that I find in my life as a writer, I'm always having to say, because I write about my actual experiences and things that I do, and the character of Andy Miller is based on me, right? The me in the books is based on the actual me. And the actual me read all those books. So I might as well, you know, have them there.
So this is not the little sort of Nintendo Wii version of you.
I wish it was.
You send out.
That would be so much better. Anyway, yeah. So that's why those are all there. And what happened was, as you can see, is if we start on the left. So I bought... I'm standing on the sofa
Andy's
now, so I can point.
On the sofa.
So I bought The Master and Margarita at the Albion Bookshop in Broadstairs in Kent. That it's not there anymore. And then we've got a copy of Middlemarch by George Eliot. And I bought that at Methven's in Canterbury. Methven's in Canterbury isn't there anymore. And then I bought Post Office by Charles Bukowski. I think I bought that at Waterstones in Charing Cross Road. It's Waterstones in Charing Cross Road, and that's not there anymore. But it's sort of each one of these books was bought from bookshops which have now vanished.
You're a terrible, terrible jinx.
I think I am.
Not publishing, Andy, it's you.
I know, but also they had them in stock. You know, you could go to Broadstairs to a little bookshop and it had a copy of The Master and Margarita just sitting on the shelf. And it strikes me that that's probably become more difficult in the last 10 years, that just happened,
there's
right?
There's a bit that you talk about in your book that made me laugh and also horrified me quite deliciously, where you talk about, for the purposes of your book, needing to read Moby Dick and having to read Moby Dick, was it on a Nintendo DS?
Yes. So right, my son, when I was little, reading these books, and... I was staying away from home and I had forgotten to take my actual copy of Moby Dick with me. And so I needed it in an emergency to look up a particular passage in Moby Dick. And my son had his DS with him. And back then you could buy a cartridge for the Nintendo DS, which was called the 100 Classic Books, that you could read on a DS, right? And it had Moby Dick in it. So we had to find a supermarket that sold DS cartridges to get that, so I could then scroll through on a DS to try and find a particular passage in Moby Dick. I did actually do that. It sounds like I made that up and didn't make it up at all. But that was partly, again, because... I was staying on the south coast, away from a place with many bookshops. Just laying your hands on a copy of Moby Dick if you didn't have brilliant internet access. Again, the world's changed so much in the last 10 or 12 years. Now you just go to Project Gutenberg and download it, wouldn't you? Or you could probably just find it in hypertext. I'm sure there's just a web page with the whole thing on it. Yeah. So you can see, we start with The Master and Margarita, and then we work our way through like the Sea, and A Confederacy of Dunces, 20,000 Streets Under the Sky, Moby Dick, Anna Karenina. And it was about the point of Anna Karenina, which is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, the 11th book, that I thought, wow, I think I'm going to write about this. So I didn't start it as to write about. I started it because I felt that I had totally worn out my enthusiasm for reading, and that what I needed to do was stop... pretending that I read all those books and actually read them. And you know what? It really worked. The cumulative effect of reading all those brilliant books one after another and finishing them, I'm sure this is a subject to which we will return, and finishing them and making them. I didn't love all of them. It wasn't the case that I read all of them and thought, oh my God, it's one amazing. Some I struggled with, some I thought were amazing, some I didn't like. But just the sense of getting back into the rhythm of reading every day really, really had a profound effect on me. I'm still sort of working through that now, I suppose.
At what point did you, as someone who reads and also enjoys and absorbs a lot of culture, did you feel confident enough in your taste and in who you were to be able to read a book or even, you know, see a film or a play or hear music and think, I do not like that. I don't think this is good.
I don't think you ever... Do you ever get over that? I don't. I'm always... It depends on what the book or record or film is, right? Mm. So if, for instance, I mean, I say this in the Year of Reading Dangerously, I've said it a lot, but I really believe it. Let's take the example of Middlemarch up there. If you read Middlemarch and you don't like Middlemarch, that isn't Middlemarch's fault. That's your fault.
Here I
right.
was blaming Middlemarch.
No. But what I mean is,
I've never read Middlemarch.
But you've never read it.
I've never read it. Can I borrow yours?
No. I never lend books. Come on, you know that. You must have worked that out. Look, there's no broken spines there.
They are on very good nick. Are you a respecter of books?
Yeah. I don't
box things.
I find this a really interesting thing. I've noticed this, like on Twitter, people are always going, "Oh, if you really love a book, then you've got to break its spine and dunk it in the bath and
really
throw it across the room."
I'm concerned about what these people are like in their romantic relationships.
I just think, well, there are other ways that you can like reading books, and that involves not hurting them, not bruising them.
Do you never read in the bath? Do you read in a quite a sort of an upright together? Because I, as a reader, I would like to take better care of books than I do, because I'm sort of, you know, I'll be making some food, you're cooking a meal and reading something, and my lovely new book is now covered in soy sauce and olive oil. Or you're very careful about where you are.
I read in non-oil based areas. I read sitting in chairs, standing up, or in bed, well, and walking down the road. But I don't read in the bath.
With a physical book walking down the road?
Yeah.
I would like to see you do that.
We can do that. That can be the peak of this podcast. You chase me down the street while
I'll create a a verbal picture.
Have you read The Dice Man?
I have not read The Dice Man. You put me off.
Did I? I'm sorry. No, sorry
but
to Luke Reinhardt if he hears
about,
this.
Because I know this is in the Year of Reading Dangerously, but can you talk about what it was like to, at what point you decided that you didn't like it, and when the crossing over from I don't like this to maybe this isn't good, or when you felt that it was okay to have a negative reaction to it?
My feeling is that, I've already mentioned this, but I came to the conclusion that as long as I finished something, I was then allowed to say what I thought. And you asked me about when I felt confident enough to do that. I think you can say what you think as long as you put the hours in, regardless of whether you feel confident or not. That's not the issue. I think the issue is that because we live now in a world where you're being encouraged to broadcast your opinions, not us necessarily, but everyone on social media or on blogs or whatever, it's good to know what you're talking about. That is how you distinguish yourself from people who don't know what they're talking about. And if you haven't finished reading the book, you don't know what you're talking about. You can have a response based on what you read, but that's about you. That's not about the book. In order to make it about the book, you've got to finish the book. But I mean, nobody likes me. I'm not a very inspiring figure, Daisy, because I think the drift is towards saying, "Oh, do what you want. Don't just read 30 pages. Chuck the book across the room.
Put it in a bath. Pour oil on it and set fire to it.
Put one star on Goodreads and say, 'Oh, you know, George Eliot failed because I didn't like this book.'" Well, that seems wrong. And that seems like consumerism has gone mad, doesn't it? It basically is in the entitled consumer is going, "I demand to be in the right. I demand to have the whip hand."
I agree. But I was curious about whether there are any books you have finished and genuinely felt confused by and thought, "I couldn't tell you if I liked that or not."
Yeah. Well, many, of course. That's the flip side. I always try and be completely honest in my response to books or films or music. And a lot of the time, you need to let things settle before you decide then what you're going to say about them. For instance, quite early on, The Sea, the Sea by Iris Murdoch. It's about a 400-page book. I reckon I got about 250 pages in. I genuinely didn't know what to make of it, which I quite liked. I don't have a problem with that. I didn't feel someone was getting one over on me.
Mm.
But I just thought, I have no... What means do I have of locating this in the tradition of other things that I've read?
I think it's good to have in this era of loving things and hating things to feel challenged by the nuances of something and to feel uncertain and shifting.
Yeah, and also what you're saying is absolutely right. And having confidence is great. Backing confidence up with a bit of legwork is also really great. So I tend to feel... Also, I tended to feel like... Like, for instance, this book here, 100 Years of Solitude by Gabriel Garcia Marquez. That is a lot of people's favourite book. Certainly people of a certain age. If you were around in the 80s, that was a very important book.
Maybe this isn't a fair thing to say, but I've always... I liked it, but I read it when I was a teenager and I really wanted to like it. And I think I really was like, oh, it's a bit... I feel like it's very hard work, but I'm missing something. I will keep going. But it seems like a bit of a boy's book. It's a book you'd put on a dating profile.
Do you think it's a boy's book? I'm a boy. Gender is another thing we're going to return to. Gender and reading, what a fascinating topic.
There are certain books where, and it might be, you know, a sensitive boy's book who'd put it on his dating profile because he doesn't want to say, I love Angie McNab on the Rampage.
Yeah, look. So actually, Gabriel Garcia Marquez in my sick library lives next to the Dice Man, lives next to Luke Reinhardt. Okay, and look on the cover of the Dice Man. The quote is from novelist of the century, Loaded. So the sensitive boy's choice is next to the insensitive boy's choice, right?
I feel like there should be, you know, see pages 96 and 213 for some raunch.
Also, you know what you notice about the books in this room is...
I should say I don't know where the raunch is. I've not read it. I will.
They're all doubled up, right? So if I, like, if I pull those out, there's a load more books behind there.
May I come up on the sofa and have
you a may, look? You right. may indeed. So you can see what's hiding behind there.
Oh, so these are all lots of music books, which is interesting. We have Never Break the Chain, which is about Fleetwood Mac.
It is.
Rip It Up and Start Again by Simon Reynolds. We think I have this book in my... I say I have this book. I think my husband has this book.
Or we've That's a great point. Book.
What do you think that loving music has... What impact has that had on your love of reading, or perhaps your occasional hate or frustration with reading?
I'm 50, and I was fortunate enough to grow up in the 1980s when pop stars read books, and there was peer pressure on musicians to talk about the books that they read. So, for instance, my favourite novel that I've ever read, which is Absolute Beginners by Colin McInnes. I know about that book because Paul Weller used to talk about it a lot in interviews in the early 1980s.
So is this copy, is that the one you had
Yes.
in your boyhood?
Yes.
When you were...
It is. I read that during a family holiday in Scotland, and I finished it on the deck of a Caledonian McBrain ferry heading back from, I want to say, from somewhere like Isla or Jura to Oban. And I couldn't... These phrases that we use all the time, right? I couldn't put it down. It's the most exciting... that book, actually, I hate the phrase I really dislike, that book's changing your life. Because when people say that, what they mostly mean is books they really like, which is fine. That book changed my life. Absolutely Beginners by Colin McInnes changed my life. 15.
You're 15 and a fan of the Jam?
Fan of the Jam, absolutely.
And was there any kind of family sense of like what you were reading? Or was it, oh, that book looks a bit adult, or oh, let Andy...
No, my mum and dad were really great, actually. We didn't have loads of books in the house. But we went to the library a lot. We went to the library every week. And, you know, I was a really a good reader. So I used to get through 3 books a week, basically take them back to the library. And my parents were really brilliant about letting me read whatever I wanted. The only thing they didn't, my mum wouldn't let me have Lookin in the house. The ITV, people will be listening to this who don't know what Lookin is, incredibly. It was TV Times for kids. And so my mum didn't really like that. But other than that, they let me read Marvel comics and they let me read rubbish old sci-fi or good sci-fi. And so they never really raised an eyebrow when I moved into reading sort of more adult books. I think Graham Greene was probably the first author that I was my first big sort of adolescent crush. And then I did behave like a boy and I read everything by Graham Greene. You know, I read stuff in sets.
You became a completist.
Very much, yeah. I've got that gene, definitely.
So what was the first Graham Greene you read? And can you remember?
Brighton Rock.
Was there any detail in there or something that happened where you're like, this is a book.
Yeah, I tell you what, I found it totally exhilarating that everyone in it was so miserable. because I too was miserable. And yet I didn't often see it reflected in, actually, funny enough, in children's books, I did tend to like, I'm talking with the benefit of hindsight, if I look at the books that I liked as a kid, for instance, the Moomin books, or Peanuts.
Yes.
I love Peanuts. We'll talk about Peanuts. They're very melancholy.
Mm.
And to me, it seemed really, those are the books I like. Those are the books that allowed children to feel sorry for themselves. And I felt very sorry for myself quite a lot of the time. So when I got to Graham Greene, also I really liked the general misanthropic. See, if there's a type of writing or performer that I like, it tends to be the miserable but funny people, right? So Eeyore, Stuart Lee, Philip Larkin. I would have said Morrissey once upon a time, but we've
a bit contentious
it's gone
now.
Off the boil somewhat. Yeah, basically. Yeah, I like all the crypto fascists, it turns out. And Michelle Welbeck, I really love Michelle Welbeck. Another misanthrope, but I find it very funny. Bruckner in her own way.
I was just going to say, you know? Both big fans of Anita Bruckner, and I think very funny, very dry, but also her heroines and her protagonists not laugh a minute, glad to be alive, isn't this fun?
If we get a chance later on, we're going to read out the opening paragraph of Anita Bruckner's first novel, because it is, I've realised that it's the greatest opening paragraph of any novel, and it's her first novel, and she didn't write any warm-ups, and she didn't write any short stories. She got to the age of about 50, that's right, isn't it? And she had a summer holiday from the Courtauld Institute, and rather than go on holiday, which is not what she wanted to do, she stayed in for 6 weeks and wrote a novel from scratch,
like
published it, and it's a masterpiece.
Pissed a party. It's like, oh, piano, I used to play the piano, and just does Flight of the Bumblebee.
Yeah. Can you do it? There's a piano behind you. Please.
I can, but I don't want to embarrass anyone. I do want to say as well, for the record, because this is your book and we're talking about reading habits and all of their glory and shame, not that there's no such thing as a guilty pleasure. I'm Catholic, all of my pleasures are guilty. I did pull back the Year of Reading Dangerously books and I did find the Da Vinci Code.
Well, that's because
that
it's in the Year of Reading Dangerously. That's not on display.
For shame, I can't remember how you found it.
Okay, so the original subtitle of... I don't know if I've ever said this on the record. Wow, it doesn't matter now. So the whole time I was writing that book, it took me 7 years to write that book. It was a long, drawn-out, difficult process. The whole time I was working on it, it was called The Year of Reading Dangerously, subtitle 50 Great Books and 2 by Dan Brown.
Yes,
right.
I think
okay,
that's
so it. That was and but then my agent said, "Oh, you can't use that as a subtitle." But they were wrong. Not that they'll ever listen to this, but they were wrong, and that's what we should have called it. So, what in the book I do a comparative study of Moby Dick and the Da Vinci Code, and what I do is I try and look for similarities between the two texts, and I find that there are quite a few. What I find fascinating about Dan Brown is that. He is tremendously successful and people derive huge pleasure from his books, and that is excellent. But he's not very good at writing. Unlike, say, Lee Child, who is very successful and people derive a lot of pleasure from his books, who is good at writing, Dan Brown isn't so good at writing in terms of forming nice sentences. Right, now, I know that sounds contentious or jealous, but I'm not jealous of Dan Brown, right? I'm just coming at it from a position or a professional expertise, let's call it, whereby I've spent a lifetime reading, writing, editing, selling books, and I read The Da Vinci Code, and what happened was I read it just after I read Moby Dick, and Moby Dick I read, it took me weeks, it was really hard, I got to the end of it, I thought, oh, that was really difficult. I bet it was a masterpiece. Whereas I read The Da Vinci Code in about 12 hours flat. And I thought, wow, I really need to read something better than The Da Vinci Code. No problem at all with popular entertainment. I love it. Escapism, fantastic.
It's not perhaps something that people can derive their nourishment from. I mean, I guess, because I suppose...
I don't know. Super
snobs that I always want to sort of speak... Like, my goodness, Dan Brown does not need me to be like, go easy on it. You know, he's having a lovely time. He's fine. But I think I'm very interested in the way that I don't know if you'd relate to this or not, but as someone who was... sort of bookish and nerdy and bullied and that books were all I had. I think I have in the past for sure been guilty of a kind of literary snobbishness where I hope I'm not this way now, but there was a time when I used to want to put the barriers up and be like, no, the complicated and difficult things, they are the best. And you can't say you're a reader and you can't say you're passionate if you're reading this thing you can buy in a supermarket, which now I think is nonsense. My goodness, as a writer, I would cut off my hands to be in a supermarket.
But Daisy, you know what? I agree with that. I agree with that 100%. But what I also feel as a reader, as someone who reads a lot and reads all sorts of different things, is it is okay to say some things are better than other things. You know, because some things are better than other things.
Do you think this is my millennial? No, everyone gets a prize.
Yes, coming in. I do. I used to, funnily enough, I used to take a very similar position to you on this. What I'm trying to say about Dan Brown is I have no problem with people enjoying books from supermarkets. I have no problem with people enjoying a format blockbuster book. Bonkbuster, misery memoir, whatever you want, whatever floats your boat. But when it comes down to it, some things are better than other things, right? And the flip side of the position you've got is that people are scared to say, like you sent me an email before we did this that said, oh, we don't need to go look on the shelf and you go, that's where I keep my Proust. You know what? We're going to go somewhere and I'm going to say, that's where I keep my Proust. Why should I cringe away from enjoying reading stuff that's good?
So, say you've got someone who doesn't really read very much, is a bit nervous about reading. Read a Dan Brown on holiday and I was like, oh, this is really good. Where do I go from here? What direction would you point them in that has those perhaps that sense of pace and excitement but is a little bit more nourishing and it is better but will keep a new reader reading?
That's a really good question. Well, I suppose I would say Lee Child. I was at a book festival with Rick Gakowski, who is a writer and rare book dealer, and He was also the chair of the Book of Judges about 5 or 6 years ago. And so I said to him, well, what are you reading at the moment? What's good? And he went, Lee Child. And I went, which one? And he went, doesn't matter. They're all the same. They're all brilliant.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
We'll be back to Andy soon, but now it's time for my Steal of the Week, a book I loved so much that paying the cover price alone seems faintly criminal. This week, I've chosen the book Santa Brought Me, Gabrielle Moss's Paperback Crush, the totally radical history of 80s and 90s teen fiction. This is a breakneck giddy and fillingly thorough book about a genre that is frequently dismissed, even though it was a formative part of the lives of the most addicted readers I know. I was overjoyed to discover The Babysitter's Club and Sweet Valley High are covered comprehensively, thrilled to find forgotten favourites like Paula Dezinger, and equally spooked and compelled to revisit Point Horror. It was published by Quirk Books at the end of October. If you've ever read something with a coloured sticker on the spine indicating that someone else thought it was slightly too old for you, you will adore this, I promise. Now back to Andy. You are, you know, undoubtedly a prolific reader and someone who's always reading. And I think a lot of what you read is dictated, sounds like a strong word, but it's informed by, you know, the work you do and what you have to be on top of. Do you ever just feel overwhelmed by the volume of books that are in the world?
Yeah. Yeah, totally. On Twitter, at the end of every month, I post a picture of the pile of books that I've been reading. And that has been really fascinating experience because all it is a photograph. And I usually say, these are the books that I read this month and my favourite was. And it's just like a public diary, really. It's a fairly vanilla sort of thing to do. People's responses to it, it's like holding up a mirror to readers. People's responses to it are totally fascinating. Some people go, oh, it's really inspiring. Some people go, why have you done that? It's made me feel bad. And a lot of people say, how do you read so much? And every month when somebody asks me, and they always ask me, I try and think of a different thing to say. Because a lot of the time they mean, why do you read so much?
Do you not ever say, because I'm reading to your mum?
makes note for next for end of month tweets. Because I'm reading for your mum, that's really good. I sort of feel, well, why do you read so much? Because the clock is ticking. You know, I reckon I've got 20 years left of good reading in me before my sight fails and my faculties begin to dwindle. And
we have the wellness industry and we'll have bionic eyes and it'll be fine. Some green juice and get new eyes. All good.
But I ended up feeling really strongly. One of the things that, as a result of doing the reading for the year of Reading Dangerously, was you can read or not read. But when it comes down to it, if you're going to read those books, you've got to read them. This sounds like such a banal thing to say, but actually, it's totally true. The difference between having read something and reading something is reading it.
That maybe your fear of not reading has to be bigger than your fear of reading.
I find the more I read and the further out of my comfort zone that I go in my reading, the bigger my comfort zone grows. That I find different things that I find I like for reasons I might not have expected that I like. And that then informs the next book that I read. So you're right that I read a lot and I do feel slightly overwhelmed by it sometimes. But on the other hand, you know, we're tremendously lucky, me and John, to be doing Backlisted. It's sort of giving us an excuse to investigate authors 26 authors a year and their backlists that we wouldn't, that I'm not saying we wouldn't read, but we have no urgent need to read. And a lot of the time that just means you never get round to it. And you're going to miss out on things that perhaps are going to become your favourite books.
I think perhaps it is a discipline, like all of the things that bring you joy, you've got to bring some effort to it. And I think this maybe goes back to your point about quote unquote difficult books, or, you know, books that are challenging, that the more you get in, the more you get out, to be very base about it.
Yeah, well, the thing is, right, I talk about this a lot, I read 50 pages a day, every day.
When?
If I can. I normally afternoon. Before I start work. So I tend to wake up quite early. So before the house is awake, I tend to read for an hour or an hour and a half. And then I get my son off to school, and then I get down to work about 7:30, 8 o'clock. But I've already done some reading, you know. I've already exercised that muscle.
Do you feel sort of generally, you know, mentally better for it and calmer? I try really hard to read for an hour in the morning instead of reaching for my phone. I don't always succeed at this, but
yes,
really
same here,
notice.
Same here. Oh no, it makes a massive difference. Just concentrating on one thing for, say, 90 minutes rather than hopping about trying to, you know, it's just really, really helpful. And that 50 pages a day thing, once you get into the rhythm of it, that really, really works. It's really helpful with longer books or more challenging books because, you know, that phrase, the book didn't grab me. Well, I sort of think that that's never going to work, is it? It's up to you to grab the book, right? And you're right, Daisy. It's what you... This sounds like tough love, doesn't it? But to some extent, you've got to put something in to get something back. And you don't have to for all books. Some books are going to carry you along and you're going to find them easy and straightforwardly enjoyable. But there's more than one way to enjoy a book, right? Just there's more than one type of dancing. You don't want to only watch Star Wars every time you go to the cinema. There's different types of film and different types
sometimes
of experience, right?
Sometimes you want to take away. Sometimes you'll go to somewhere nice.
What you want is a balanced diet. But we only talk about books in those terms. Books have this weird thing because of people's status anxiety around them or the cultural baggage that comes with them. It sounds like what I'm recommending is only roughage. That's not what I mean. What I mean is you just got to, the more you balance it out, the wider you throw the net, the more likely it is you'll enjoy more of what you read. I think reading is a skill as well.
Yeah.
You know, and the more you read, the better you get at it.
But hopefully it is a skill because it's not something you're born with, that it is democratic, that all you need is to go in with enthusiasm and a commitment to make it work. You don't have to be, you know, necessarily predisposed to academia or anything
that. Were you good at reading at school?
I was, but like I said, bullied, no friends, a lot of free time.
See, I was good at reading at school. It's the only thing that I've ever been naturally good at. And can I say that you had the great advantage, though, if you were good at reading at school, in that you are a girl. Whereas, as a boy, I was the only boy who was good at reading, right? And at primary school, what used to happen was they put you in the top readers group and all the other readers were girls and they were really mean. They were really mean. So that reading as a solitary occupation for a boy. I mean, the thing is, I think you read a lot of books about reading. The one thing that they have in common is they've all been written by people who will say, unreasonably, I was a solitary child who didn't have many friends and enjoyed, you know, the company of books because books could make sense of the world where other people couldn't. I think that's one of the really fantastic and enjoyable things about, funnily enough, the last 10 years or so with like social media and Twitter and whatever. I do feel like that's the first time ever that there is, for all its many faults, that there is a sort of democratic means of talking about books and connecting with people who feel the same way about books as you do and about reading as you do.
And when you do have that excitement and that real urge to just press something into people's hands, and I think, you know, if I was richer and madder, I'd be down Speaker's Corner with 50 copies in the pack. Take it, take it.
Don't you think? So I think the best thing about Twitter is the book recommendation. Because I was thinking about this, I think the thing is so fantastic. Certainly back when it was 140 characters, and it, in a sense, all you had space to say was, I really love this, or I didn't really love it.
It's quite aesthetic blurbing, isn't
it? And there
it?
Wasn't an exchange of kind of status. Not really. You could just go... And the number of book recommendations that I've had via Twitter, which have turned out to be fantastic, or introduced me to authors that I really like, far more than, say, the books pages of newspapers, or books that friends might give you. The thing about books given to you by friends is they tend to be based on their judgment of the things they think you like, and therefore when you read that book you're having to go back with, I always find those quite pressured things. If someone presses a book into my, if you gave me a book now because we've met, that would be more difficult. Because I'd be thinking, oh, I don't want to offend. What if I don't like this? I don't want to offend.
Has anyone ever given you a book that offended you? Have you ever thought, really? They thought I'd like that?
Yes, but I cannot say what it is. Oh. I'm really sorry. I'll tell you when the mic's off. I can tell you what it is. But mostly no.
Right, what's
mostly
the most flattering book?
You know, the worst. No, the worst thing is not that. The worst thing is when you're given a book and you think, oh, it's all right. It's almost better to go back and go, why did you give me that? It was awful. Or, God, I absolutely love that. Thank you so much. But if you read it, and the truth of it is, most books that we read, we don't think are amazing or be awful. Most things that we read, they're fine. You know, it was all right. Actually, that's sort of damning it with faint praise as a return of a gift, isn't it? So you went, did you read that book I got you? Yeah, it's fine. And even though that might be the truth, you know, you can't...
I suppose you are absolutely in both worlds because you do read so much, but also as a writer, you know what it's like to sit down for something every day for months or years and it be your book that you're writing. I've always got that in my mind when I read something. But I mean, very occasionally I read something, and what did you do with the rest of the hour? But
I remember when I was a bookseller in the 90s, and I remember going to a talk given by one of the heads of publishing at Puffin Books. And when it got to questions, the first two or three questions were like booksellers or other members of the public going, why did you publish that book? It wasn't very good. Or I read this and I it wasn't good. Why have you put this out there? And she said, she slightly lost her temper and said something I've never forgot. She went, no, you don't understand. Nobody writes or publishes a book because they think it's bad. You are attributing bad faith to people where none exists. Everyone, when they sit down to write, does so in good faith that they are about to do their best. And the book has been brought to you equally by the publisher who wants you to read it. They don't want you not to read it. They may make bad decisions. They may get it wrong, or they may have targeted it accidentally at a group of people who are in fact less likely to enjoy it, but nobody's sitting around going, ha, we got that piece of old crap away. It doesn't work like that. And so as a writer, I always think, it's true, isn't it?
I feel like the cowboy publishers.
Publishers get, you know, the thing
just
is, having been,
get out.
Having been a publisher, publishers, you know, are... And to quote Douglas Adams, fraught with interest. The subject of publishing is fraught with interest. But actually, publishers get blamed for a lot of stuff, which is as much the fault of, say, the editors of the books pages or the literary agents or the public. You know, the public's appetite for the books they want to read. You know, publishing is a business, and a lot of the time the publisher is seeking to give their customer what they want. Would you like to see the shed?
Yeah,
I would very much like to see the shed.
So,
my poor mother is constantly buying. She can't walk past a charity shop without coming out with five books, and she gets incredibly excited. I remember what she found in Muriel Sparkle. God, was it? Quite a new one. Might be in Memento Mori. It's lovely in here. So I should take my shoes off again. We are now in Angie Miller's shed.
This is where the magic happens.
There's a waterbed. All the furniture has goldfish swimming around
it. Does.
It's very cosy.
What can you describe? Would you want to? Shall I describe what's in here? So basically, I've got a desk and lots of music and my guitar and an amp and a bottle of mezcal and a Hancock's half-hour board game and then books and books and books, as you can see. I will show you, right? Everything left of here, I haven't read those.
So
this is the TBR.
So the TBR is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 shelves and about 10 little piles. I'm not really
doubled up. Yeah, and then everything in from this direction to the end, I've read most of those. I haven't read everything, but they tend to be things that I've been reading or things that we've done for Backlisted. These piles on the floor here, these are things that I've probably read all of these this year. So there tend to be, as you can see, blocks of... but I don't... Having worked in a bookshop, I can never have books in alphabetical order. You can see I've got them by author in clumps.
I could do something really obnoxious. You might not want to do it. But if I have to grab a book off the shelf, how would you sell it to me? I'm going to, probably because this is a book that I do know you've read. Should I buy this book, Mom, darling? 99 Glimpses of Princess Margaret.
Okay, so first of all, you wouldn't say that. What the thing that you'd say is have you read this? Is it good? Now, that is two separate questions. If I told the truth about that book, it would be, yes, I have read it, and yes, it is good. Not only is it good, it is fantastic. But a lot of the time, what the customer means when they say, have you read this, is it good, as they wave a Joanna Trollope at you, is I, Andy Miller, would never read a Joanna Trollope, perhaps incorrectly. Perhaps I should change my mind about that. Is it good? I don't know. You don't want me to say that. What you want me to say is yes to both. Yes, I have read it. Yes, it's good. Have you read this?
I have read this and I loved it. I'm thinking about getting you to read a bit out. I don't know if that would be...
Yes, Mom Darling by Craig Brown, which is a sort of biography of Princess Margaret, but sort of a deconstruction of the idea of a biography of Princess Margaret. It's also, it must be said, incredibly funny, because Craig Brown can turn a comic sentence better than almost anybody else in prose terms, I think. And so that came out, when did that come out? This time
end
last year.
Yeah.
And it's been a really big bestseller, I'm happy to say. Although a lot of baffled reviews on Amazon.
I'm not sure. I suppose because people who like books about the royal family are not necessarily going to love this. But it's the detail, isn't it? The economy of the human. That's not economic as in there's not very much of it spread around, but it's just the gag rate is constant and nothing is wasted, I think, in the description.
He's got such a good eye. So, yes. So I think you should buy that, even though you've already read it.
It's so good, I'll buy another.
All right, excellent. I've done my job.
Have a lending copy. I did want to ask you about whether you ever buy rare books or if you've ever spent a lot of money on a particular book because you love it so much and you wanted to have the special copy.
Yes, there it is.
I've got that copy of Look At Me. It was a present from producer Dale.
We both owned first editions of Look At Me by Anita Bruckner, which is a book that I read probably about 2 years ago. And I think is probably my favourite book that I've read in the last 10 years. And it was the third or fourth Bruckner that I read in quick succession. And anyone who's listened to Backlisted will know that I go on and on and on about Anita Bruckner and how much I like Anita Bruckner. So I bought that as a first edition because I thought, well, I absolutely love that book. I've got another... I bought this as well. Hang on. So I'm hiding away here. Here's a... first edition of Tigers Are Better Looking by Jean Rees, which is a book of...
Oh, that colour is fabulous. Can you describe it a bit?
It's a lady looking slightly distracted, staring out of a window. Jean Rees's... This book was published in 1968 after the success of Wide Sargasso Sea. And In fact, the stories in it, she'd been trying to sell this volume of stories for at least 10 years before the success of Wide Sargasso Sea, and nobody would publish her. And I won't recap the sad story of Jean Rhys's life, but Tigers Are Better Looking contains 8 short stories. I think it's probably my favourite collection of short stories by anybody. I think it's an incredible book. And discovering Jean Rhys... Actually, this is what's so interesting, you see. I mean, I sort of discovered Jean Rhys, her 30s novels, and Bruckner in the last 10 years. And I think all the writers who have most affected me or I consider to be the most enjoyable books that I've read in the last 10 years, they've all been female. It's all writing by women. You can see here, there's a shelf here of novels and books of short stories by Elizabeth Taylor, not the actress. And also over there, Sylvia Townsend Warner, there's a novel here called The Corner That Held Them, which is set in the 1400s in a nunnery, which I think is the best historical novel I've ever read, The Corner That Held Them, by Sylvia Townsend Warner.
These Viragos are gorgeous.
And if I see old Virago editions, then I buy those because I really love that look. But I'm really... It goes back to what I was saying earlier about reading outside your comfort zone. And it seems such a straightforward thing, but actually Anita Bruckner is a fascinating example of it. You know, there is no question that Anita Bruckner was not published in such a way that would attract male readers. Mm. She's very much pitched at a female constituency. That is who her publisher thought was most likely to buy her books. Mm. As a result of which, you know, I had read Hotel du Lac many years ago, but she's not... it's ludicrous to think that she wrote only for women. Mm. Of course she didn't. And one of the great heartening things about doing Backlisted and certainly championing a writer like Anita Bruckner on Backlisted is the number of men who have felt that they... not that they need permission, but you know what I'm saying, that they can investigate writers like Anita Bruckner who perhaps they wouldn't, you know, pick up in a bookshop. Like, there's another one down here. When Lucy Mangan came on, she chose the novels of a writer called Nora Lofts. And I'm just going to show you what Nora Lofts' books look like, right? And you will record your reaction.
Wow, I love it. It seems super, super 70s, but...
Imagine how I felt sitting on the train reading that. Right, it is.
And there's a girl in the front who looks like cover. She might maybe have sex with a dragon later.
Yeah, she doesn't. In fact, Nora Lofts is a fantastically gritty writer who's not sentimental, like that cover would suggest, who doesn't write in a particularly female way, as that cover would suggest.
That we're going to take a picture, but it's very. It's borderline Mills and Booney, I'd say.
Yeah.
Gothic script, beautiful. Young woman in a sort of princessy headdress, long flowing velvet gown, looking sad and pensive. She's doing a sort of Katie Price, Jordan, blowing bubbles and staring at the sunset. Best. Bloody hell!
Right, now...
Fuck, there's ringlets!
I guess the point I want to make is, it's always a lesson to me that you can't judge a book by the cover. Funny that, isn't it? In fact, but we just do. But we do. We as people, we all do that. Look, yeah. Daisy, look. That's where I keep my Prousts.
Actually, where
do I keep them? What are they next to?
They are next to the Peanuts.
So Marcel Proust and Charles M. Schulz, two of the greatest writers there have ever been, live next to one another on the shelf.
And very close to Andy Miller.
Also.
No, he's beneath them. You see, he's literally beneath them.
But you're getting up there. You're getting up to the... But the Proust, I can't quite see. I might need to
walk
over there. But the Proust, the spine, they look quite cakey. Is that deliberate? That's a really beautiful shelf.
Yes. Somebody said, actually, they're not so much Madeline as Battenberg. Yeah. So that's a 90s edition that was published in the mid-90s, vintage paperbacks of Proust.
Was it you who said on a Backlisted that everybody talks about the Madelines because it's quite near the beginning?
Yes. In fact, I read the final volume, Time Regained, last month, and that is one of the great reading experiences I've ever had. I'm keen to make the point that I found reading the whole thing at times extremely challenging. It made my teeth itch at points, but the payoff is so incredible in the final volume.
How did you read straight, or did you read one and then read other things?
Oh no, I've read like about 400 or 500 pages a month and took a break because I could see one of the reasons why I suspect people run aground is it's a hard thing to read anyway. It's quite challenging to read anyway, and you know, 300 pages on one dreadful dinner party, for instance, can bring the spirits down a bit. But
actually, I suppose that's Patrick Melrose territory, really, isn't it?
Oh, I love those books. Look, they're down there. Look, there's my Melrose's there.
I put me in mind a tiny bit of Anthony Pohl, who I, thanks to you, now have to pronounce.
Anthony Pohl, let's walk over. Here is
sort of shuffling,
like, here is A Dance to the Music of Time by Anthony Pohl.
They're fabulous. These Mandarin.
They're from the 90s, yeah. And there's a guide by Hilary Sperling to A Dance to the Music of Time. This book's absolutely brilliant. This basically tells you who all the characters are so that you can look them up by character. When you meet someone in, say, Volume 9, who you haven't met since Volume 5, it's quite useful to turn to that.
It's a Game of Thrones with shabby overcoats and communists, really, isn't it?
I totally agree, actually. There is a definite, the sort of Pole St. Aubyn thing. What else can you see?
I see Mimmins. Oh, these are lovely.
So that's the last, I've just put out some really nice reproduction editions of the Moomin books. And these are the ones that Puffin put out about 10 years ago, the little hardbacks.
And so these are books that you knew and loved.
Yeah, they were my favourite books when I was a kid. Particularly the last two, Moomin Pupper at Sea and Moomin Valley in November. We've just done a backlisted about Moomin Valley in November with Frank Cottrell Boyce, which was really brilliant to be able to go back and look at that. And I really like both of these books because they're so melancholy. Moomin Pupper at Sea, particularly, is basically a midlife crisis book. These are the things that I liked when I was 10. they were waiting for me.
Did you ever have any moments, sort of in as a teenager or a young adult, where you would seek out these very comforting childhood books and with a bit of you knowing, oh, I'm sort of, these are books from my past, but I'm taking them into my present?
Yes, there's a brilliant example of that. There's a book called Ludo and the Star Horse by Mary Stewart, which I remember being on Jackanory when I was a kid, and I got it out of the library every week on the same ticket and read it and reread it, and I really loved it. It's about a boy in Switzerland. His horse escapes and he chases into the storm after the horse, and he gets a bang on the head, and he dreams that he's in the houses of the Zodiac, and in order to get home, he has to pass through each of the houses of the Zodiac. And I didn't know what this book was called for years and years and years. And then I Googled something like Jackanory Houses of the Zodiac, and I found it. I found what the book was and I bought it.
Is it here?
No, it's in my son's room.
Ah.
Because I read it to my son when he was about 7 or 8. And it was slightly embarrassing because I sort of cried near the end. Have I brought them from the past into the present? Yes, absolutely. Having a child, of course, gives you a lovely excuse to be able to do that. Not that you should need one. But, hey, have you read this? So this is Ridley Walker by Russell Hoban. And the reason, because you both live in Margate.
We do live in Margate.
And this book is set round Margate, Broadstairs, Whitstable, Canterbury, and here is the little map at the front showing you that in the future Margate and Ramsgate have broken off from the Isle of Thanet and are now on a place called the Ram. And here's Widder's Bell, Whitstable, Horny Boy, Herne Bay, Ramgut, there you are, Sandwich, Sam's Itch, Cambry rather than Canterbury, River Sour rather than River Stour. I had never read this book before this year. It is absolutely mind-blowingly brilliant. It's all written. Can you see, Daisy, read the beginning if you can.
On my naming day, when I come 12, I go in front spear and kilt a wild boar. He probably ben the last wild pig on the Bundle Downs. Anyhow, there hadn't been none for a long time before him, nor I ain't looking to see none again.
You've got the gig. The audiobook is yours.
It's a little bit, reminds me of doing Old English in my student times, but also Molesworth.
It's such a brilliant, brilliant book. Ridley Walker by Russell Hogan. Such a great book. Can I talk a bit about Penelope Fitzgerald?
Yes, please do.
Okay, so...
Well, I love it. There are quite a number of different... But it's, again, I think it's that completism where there'll be a number of books by the same writer that are a bit like the Anthony Poles. These Penelope Fitzgeralds, it's a series and there's a lovely rainbow in the spine. They do look lovely on a shelf.
Penelope Fitzgerald does not require the endorsement of me, Andy Miller. Right, she is a well established as one of the most interesting, skillful and witty novelists of the last 50 years. But I hadn't read her. I think I'd read the one you're looking at the moment, The Bookshop, and I thought it was okay. But I decided I would read them chronologically this year, and I'm a great believer actually in reading an author's work chronologically because you begin to see more of their development and how they change as they go along. And actually, Penelope Fitzgerald starts as a sort of contemporary novelist, slightly Brucknerish certainly, and then she becomes this incredible historical novelist as she goes on. This book here, The Beginning of Spring, which I read last month, is my favourite book that I've read this year, and by extension, therefore, one of the best books that I've read in the last 10 years. It is set in Russia in 1913. And it is about an English printer and his family. It is the most incredible recreation of a time and a place that you wouldn't necessarily know much about.
Introduction by Andrew Miller.
No relation. Yeah. And as everybody says, Philip Hensher says, how does she do it? How does she do the trick? And as I get older, that's really what I want from books. Mm. You know, a lot of time I read things and I think, OK, well, that's good. You've done that. Or that's a good way of doing that. Or that's an interesting. I see what you. When I read Penelope Fitzgerald, like when I was a child, I can't see how she does it. And that's magical to me. That really is magical. Even as a writer and an editor and somebody who reads a lot, when I find a writer where I think, what? I don't. How are you? You know, when you get to the end of a book and you read the last page and the ending seems simultaneously unpredictable, unguessable and entirely inevitable, that is the mark of a great book. Where you can't know how it would end, but once you've read it, it feels the only possible ending that there could have been.
Huge thanks to Andy and to our listeners. You can find him on Twitter at IAmMillIAm with underscores between the words. I'm Daisy Buchanan and you've been listening to Your Booked. If you want to see some strong cover art, show me your shelfies or tell me about your favourite Babysitter's Club style moment, you can find me on Instagram at TheDaisyBee or on Twitter at NotRollerGirl. Visit acast.com/booked for a list of all the books mentioned on today's episode. If you'd like to get in touch about the show, email us at whybooked@gmail.com. Your Booked is produced by Dale Shaw for New Alaska and hosted by Acast. If you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe, rate us and leave a review. We love hearing what you think and it helps other people find the podcast. Join me next time for more spine-chilling moments and acts of shelf abuse.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.